The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge. Watching us on Access Pittsfield Channel 1301 and on the PCTV Select app. Glad you're here with us this morning. This is, what is it? It's Thursday. It's February 5th already. It's kind of a quiet morning out there. A little bit of clouds, a little bit of sun. Not too bad. I kind of getting used to the cold weather. It's only 13 degrees outside the studio. And it's going to be cold again this weekend, I hear. But we'll see. Once we get through this, maybe we'll start to have some decent weather. It's in the middle of the winter. What are you going to expect, right? Got a great show for you this morning. We have Greg Sukenik and Mary Jane Williams, reporters at the Berkshire Eagle. And we're going to be talking about the state of journalism today and the challenges to journalism. Obviously, in the headlines right now, everything going on at the Washington Post. And going to talk about that and also some more local topics and stories, some of the things these reporters are working on here in the local area in the Berkshires and Pittsfield. So looking forward to that show quite a bit. Here we go. Let's do the weather forecast from the National Weather Service, and we'll get right back to that conversation. Here we go. Berkshire
weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Extreme cold watch in effect from Saturday evening through Sunday afternoon. Today, mostly sunny. Cold with highs in the mid-20s. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Cold with lows around 3 above. North wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Yeah, I was hearing that we're going to have one of those. You know, they keep saying it. You're going to have some of the coldest weather this winter so far. And I've heard that about three or four times in the last couple weeks. But that's what I was hearing again, is we're going to have another very cold, I guess, Friday night into Saturday, Saturday into Saturday night. But we'll see. That's the warning we get there. All right, Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, and I want to start out the program just by reading this short little paragraph. You might be familiar with it. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. First Amendment, folks, that is it, and my guest this morning, two champions of the First Amendment, if you will, here in our local area, Greg Sukenik and Mary Jane Williams. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing pretty well. I see we're playing the greatest hits this morning.
Which one?
It's our First Amendment.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? I mean, that's why we're here on the air this morning. That's why we're able to come on and talk to you this morning. And feel free to speak the way that we want to speak and say the things we want to say.
Uh-oh. I don't know,
true,
how much,
right?
You want that.
That First Amendment is under threat in the last at least year, maybe longer, 10 years. What, Greg, what do you think? What's your opinion of how the protections that we have as a nation, as a community, to be able to express ourselves and to get news and information freely, is that under threat?
You know, the reporters being arrested for doing their jobs is something you expect to see sort of, you know, rarely. And yeah, Usually it's some horrible mistake, and it's not, you know, it's overreach. It's a sheriff who's, you know, it's something you'd see on television, a sheriff who's like, whose power has gone to his head or something.
And usually immediately it's swatted down,
yeah,
right? It's like, no, you can't do that. And the courts, the judges will say, right, get out of my courtroom.
And yes, these reporters, you know, Don Lemon being the most notable of them, but not the only one, mm-hmm, have been working with these activists who staged a protest in a church, and that's tough stuff. But at the same time, it's that's very much also covered by the First Amendment, and winds up in, you know, charged by the federal courts, you know, after several tries, by the way, several courts, you know, saying, no, we don't want any part of that, did some judge shopping, I guess, because it was doing their jobs and, you know, facing federal charges. And that's, you might sort of, well, I mean, what are the odds that these stand up in court? But at the same time, are those really chances you want to take? And that's kind of chilling.
Mm. Right. And let's talk about chilling, right? Because that is a concept that you learn in journalism school. Anyone who's been in the industry and understands what that means, Mary Jane, when someone wants to chill you out from writing a story, and the term prior restraint, which is a kind of a more complicated, fancy term for it, right? Why is that threat important to know what that is?
It's very important because when people, especially when governments sense that a story is coming out that it doesn't exactly benefit them, they're really going to try to do everything in their power to prevent that story from coming out. That could be discrediting the journalist. That could be trying to discredit the story itself, claiming that it's AI, finding some way to silence the journalist. You know, there's a myriad of ways that people go about that at this point.
I mean, there's, you know, there's trying to spin a reporter, and then there's prior restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's like one thing is like, well, there's really no news here. There's, you know, these people are full of it. You shouldn't be listening to them. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, you write that and I'm going to put you in jail. And that's a whole mm-hmm. different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know. Not friendly fish either.
Yeah. So the Don Lemon episode, and we use that name because a lot of people know who Don Lemon is.
He's not the only one who was affected by it.
No.
To be certain. I wish I remember the other names in the back of my head.
The other one I was thinking of was Georgia Fort, who was yes. another reporter that was with Don Lemon. Now, the situation, the condition was they're in a church. There's a protest going on in a church. Not the first time a protest has happened in a church. And he is in there ostensibly to report on what's happening at that event. That is what a journalist does. Now, regardless of whether he works for a major outlet, a newspaper, a local newspaper, on his own, does it matter?
No. He's got every right to be there. I mean, it's private property. I suppose they could, you know, ask him to leave if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's public property, you know, and he's there at the invitation of the people who are, you know, who are speaking out,
mm-hmm.
he's got every right to be there and to do that job. Period, paragraph.
Yeah.
End of story.
Mm-hmm. And the chilling effect there is if you make an example of one journalist or a group of journalists in a particular situation, I suppose what the message is don't end up like this person. Don't do this. You know, make sure that you're protecting yourself rather than getting the story. And that's a hard choice for a journalist, right? For someone who's going in, because you are weighing things in your own mind. It's hard to be brave, but sometimes that's what you have to do in a situation like that.
Absolutely. And that's also one of the difficult things that we're seeing. And, you know, nowadays with the protests, typically when journalists would wear their journalist vests during protests, it was sort of a sign of immunity. And now it's almost the opposite. Right now
it's almost
a target on your back. Exactly. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely an example of the chilling effect that we're seeing nowadays is journalists being physically targeted as well.
And there's nothing different about that than, let's say, embedding a journalist in a military campaign of some kind, right, where mm-hmm. You're along for the ride. There are certain things that you maybe can and can't say in that situation, but you're going to report out at some point. That's the whole point of an embed.
We got some of the best journalism of the last century out of, you know, reporters embedded with the Army in Vietnam, and maybe they, you know, maybe the, you know, the government learned its lesson and tried mm-hmm. to control them more after that. But mm-hmm. I mean, that told us what was really happening on the ground and, you know, gave us, you know, the clear picture that, you know, this war is not winnable the way we're fighting it. So it's, you can tell I cut my teeth reading, you know, Vietnam journalism books when I was Mary Jane's age. I don't know. I don't think I have another point after that. But
yeah.
You know, it's there's always been risk to it. I mean, I remember being a little kid and watching The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and watching Liberty Valance make the reporter try to, like, actually physically eat the copy that he had written. And I was like, oh boy, that affected little me. Mm. But here I am. So that there's a little bit of a risk when you do the work, because sometimes you don't know how people are going to respond. But I mean, so you do the work, you be accurate, you be fair, and you have to sort of you got to live with the consequences. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the emergence of sort of citizen journalism, if you will. What's going on in Minneapolis right now, and has been for a while, has been impacted a lot by ordinary people pulling out their phones and recording what's happening, right? So in the past, that didn't exist. You might have someone with a Brownie camera or something like that, maybe take a picture of Zapruder film from 1963. I think of some things like that, maybe the beginnings of it. But nothing like what we have now, where hundreds of people have devices in their pockets that can record what's going on from different angles at different times. And the proof in some ways is irrefutable. Is that also journalism? Does that play into what journalism is today? Has that changed and morphed the way that you all do your work?
Absolutely. In this day and age, citizen journalism, to put it frankly, is vital. Hmm. It completely impacts our work. We're getting the citizen's point of view. And of course, as I said, journalists are being targeted sometimes. So we need to get the viewpoints of the actual public, We can't have governments, we can't have officials spinning this off. We need this physical video evidence. But then, there's also the issues nowadays of AI and are these videos even real? So, I mean, there is another layer of that with journalists that when we use it for our work, we do need to verify all of these videos.
And not only are people taking these pictures, but they're going out to the public in real time.
Right.
It's instantaneous. Yeah. I mean,
live streaming or very soon afterward they're showing up.
So it's not exactly an accident that people with phones are being targeted by, folks who don't want you to see what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I kind of thought about what you just mentioned about the Vietnam experience and the embeds and things like that, and where the government learned its lesson at that time and said, oh, well, we can't allow that again because we're losing control of the story. The government wants to have the story, in that situation kind of wrapped up. And so here we are in a new era with new embeds, but there are hundreds of them and all around. And how do you control that? I don't see that being controlled.
No, and I think that's one of the sort of the lessons of Minneapolis, and we're going to learn a lot of those. And this is going to be something that's going to be studied in history books a long time from now. But one is that this whole notion that of control, and that this genie is so far out of the bottle. There's when you have a public that can put information out into the world in real time, there's no realistic way to sort of control that unless you really start cracking down. And so, knock, knock.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I think, what a lot of people are concerned about, because it's an erosion of our rights on many different levels, right? Because if you were to take down some of the tenets of the First Amendment, which I just read on the air a moment ago, what's to say that you can't take some of the other ones down, right? The peaceably to assemble, it's right in there. Freedom of the press, it's right in there. You've got Second Amendment advocates that are starting to feel the pressure as well, because maybe their rights that they thought they had are not going to be, stood up either. Fourth Amendment, privacy laws, and I know I do want to talk about the Washington Post a little bit here, because that seems to be another big center of the story of journalism right now in 2026. So let's jump over to that. Obviously, big news yesterday about the layoffs, and I want to go back a couple weeks first and talk about the invasion of a reporter who had sources. Private sources, anonymous sources that she was working with, and they came into her house, they took her devices, they got some passwords, they got access to other encrypted sources and things like that. So it's kind of game over, really, for that reporter in a lot of ways, right? talk, Mary Jane, talk a little bit about what it takes to work with a source on a story and how important it is to protect that source in order to get the story out.
It's everything to protect your sources. And anyone who goes into journalism knows that that is a commitment as a journalist. If you make a promise to a source to protect them, you have to do everything in your power to protect them, or else, honestly, you're just not doing, you're not upholding your job as a journalist, because it is to uplift citizens and check, call out these major institutions. So when it comes to protecting the little guy, it's part of our duty. And so it's so disheartening to see situations like that where journalists do try to uphold their job and they try to uphold this commitment that they have, and it ends up being torn away from them.
And, you know, here's the question, right? A source is the heart of the story. This is something that as you get a lead and you know you're started sniffing around, you're saying, I think there might be a story here. You're going to reach out to either someone you already know in that situation, or maybe you're going to find a new source to give you information. It's information as reporters. You don't know until that point you're building that story, right? And so a lot of times that information is going to be hurtful for whoever it is that is being reported on. Potentially, right? Whether it goes after their employment or whether it goes after their person or whatever. I mean, those are all potential things. So you're really weighing a lot with that information.
And you're doing your due diligence as well. I mean, you're running down what they're telling you. And I mean, they sort of have internal rules about, okay, well, if you have how many anonymous sources do you have to have, you know, sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Verifying what you've been told, you know, so you have, you know, So there's an idea that, okay, well, this isn't just one person, you know, running off. We've actually got some, you know, verifiable information that says, yeah, this you know, my understanding is this happened.
Yeah.
You know, my understanding is these facts are the way that they're being laid out by this other person.
Is there a golden number of those sources before you say this actually happened and it's not just a rumor?
It varies across the industry.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's three. I've seen five. I think NBC has insisted on five now.
Yeah, it also really depends on their positions, especially in the actual.
You know, and how much of this is firsthand information? You know, I mean, that comes back to our jobs, and also in a world where AI is a thing. You know, being able to verify information and tell you that, you know, what I see in front of me is actually the truth.
Is that getting harder and harder now?
I haven't run across that a ton myself, but I think nationally, I can only imagine. You know, I know that there's some talk about, I think one of the Republican candidates for governor is using AI in a commercial. I think it was Brian Shortsleeve talking about, you know, well, if Maura Healey was honest, this is what she'd say, and has like a sort of AI broadcast of her talking, you know, sort of up. And that's kind of, we're starting to slide down that slippery slope, aren't we? You know, until we get to the point where, you know, I mean, you can literally put words into somebody's mouth and pass it off as something
that actually happened.
So, I mean, the amount of care that we have to put into this now just sort of ratchets up.
Because there's one thing about satire, right? I mean, I think we all get that. Okay, you'd like to post a funny picture of someone because it, you know, makes them look funnier. I mean, political cartoons have been doing that for 250 years. So that isn't unusual. And using AI as another tool to maybe do that. The difference is, are you placing that person or that, you know, story in a situation that didn't actually happen, and then saying this actually did, or it becomes viral enough that it becomes the truth for a good number of people, enough people to act or make a decision on it.
Of course. I mean, the major difference is deception. If you're using AI to try to convince people that this is what happened, that is completely different from political cartoons that are meant to be exaggerated, because that is also protected by the First Amendment.
Clearly. We're speaking with Greg Sokenik and Mary Jane Williams, reporters at the Berkshire Eagle this morning on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, all about journalism today, national and local journalism. I know you're going to find this fascinating. I am certainly. So much to talk about this morning. I want to move on to that Washington Post story because it must hit home for you and for everyone at the Berkshire Eagle, knowing that a major national newspaper like the Washington Post, really an icon of the industry, could be basically, you know, gutted. They're taking a wrecking ball to the Washington Post on so many levels. And it really comes down to one guy, one plutocrat, Bezos, right? Yeah. I mean, that's ultimately what's going on here. Here's a guy that, with his pocket change, could keep the Washington Post running. Also spent $75 million on a film to promote that will make, you know, $8 million back. But he can't keep the Washington Post running. So I guess in the most extreme case, look at that and then look at what we have with the Berkshire Eagle. What are the big differences between that big newspaper that can't somehow turn a profit or stay afloat with the importance of all the stuff that the Washington Post has done and continues to do, and how we're able to keep that model working here in Pittsfield?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about public interest. Here we're a hyper-local paper. Everything that we report on directly affects the people who are going to be reading what we do. And of course, not to say that that isn't true for the Post. However, there are many other national outlets that are also covering the same thing. And again, we have local ownership. We have ownership by people who care and are active in the community. To be completely frank, the Washington Post has been going down since Jeff Bezos bought it. Mm. And I think everyone in the industry knows that as well. And it's very scary. And also when it comes to national news, I'd say at this day and age, it's definitely more susceptible to AI than, you know, hyperlocal papers, just because, like, we need the reporters on the ground.
Mm. Yeah, I think it comes down to commitment. Like, you know, if Mr. Bezos really wanted to, you know, as you mentioned, like pocket change.
Yeah.
I mean, how much are you worth, sir? I mean, didn't he have a destination wedding? You know, it was how many million dollars?
One of the most expensive in the...
Yeah, so...
Not to mention the yacht.
I mean, I had folks complain because we got married in Williamstown. It's like, why do you have to drive all the way up there? where was I going? Wait a minute. So, I mean, I know it's... There were a lot of folks at one of my former jobs, ESPN, who actually had connections to the Washington Post. A couple of their, you know, personalities on was it Pardon the Interruption?
Mm-hmm.
From there, lots of folks whom I've worked with, you know, have worked, you know, we're also have Washington connections as well. And so it's kind of deeply felt. And anytime a major flagship of our industry has something happen like this, it sends shockwaves, you know, through everywhere. I was like, okay, well, we know this doesn't feel like it's quite as about financial need as some other situations have been, where this is, you know, where it's tougher to make money in this industry, but this is a national brand. This is a global brand, and you know, owned by a multi-gazillionaire. So that kind of rings hollow. And I think also where the cuts are happening, sports is. But that's a connection that, I mean, okay, it's just sports. If you're listening, I hope you hear the finger quotes. But you know, that's
and
something.
If you talk to any sports fan, they'll tell you that is the most important thing in their entire
it's
lives.
It's important to people, right? who live in Washington and follow the Wizards or the Nationals or the Commanders, all the teams that have different names than when I was a kid. and you know, that's something that connects to your community. Also, there were cuts in the metro section.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what connects to the community together.
Right.
And if we're eroding that,
and not to mention the metro section is
Washington D.C.
historically, right? Washington D.C. and the same desk that broke the Watergate,
exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Woodward and Bernstein.
Right. I mean, that really sort of kind of rips away. Judge Rupper likes to talk about sort of how we are sort of the central square, the Zocalo, if you will.
Mm.
And that's actually sort of targeting the things that are the central square about Washington and taking them out. I mean, because people love their teams, that's not just, you know, the pro teams either. We're talking about high school sports as well. I mean, the stuff that people are actually interested in. Refrigerator journalism is, as Kevin likes to say. and we're also talking about, you know, things that are happening. The city council, how is a city that, by the way, is kind of federally occupied, you know, dealing with that situation, and we're removing that coverage as well. It boggles the mind.
Yeah, and that goes along, you know, we'll with a tailwind to what happened with the Pittsburgh Post Gazette, right? Another newspaper that the main daily newspaper in Pittsburgh. Not, I think they were not publishing every single day However, now they're wrapping up completely, and it just begs the question. I mean, there's something where Pittsburgh sports, right? I mean, that's a major American city with the huge sports teams, huge fans. That's gone. Washington Post taking their sports department completely away. I guess 30% of their employees gone as of yesterday, including some on the international desk and their books and the podcast and several other things. Amazing. So where do we see ourselves on the other side of this? It seems like we're kind of in the middle of a process right now where it's hard to see where this lands and where this ends. Are we shrinking the number of major news outlets in the country during this process? And will we only be left with hyper-local papers like the Berkshire Eagle that can survive on what they do? Big question, sorry.
Definitely a big question. But when it comes down to it, too, I'm not here to say that hyper-local papers are all immune and all safe at all. I mean, I think the Berkshire Eagle, if anything, is an outlier just because we have such an involved community and we're such an established paper. Again, not to say, though, that the Washington Post isn't. So it's definitely very scary to think about. Not much other way to put that.
I think one of the key differences for the Eagle, I mean, I like to tell people this, like, yeah, we have local ownership. That's you know, number one, we have local ownership that wants to win on quality. That's the second thing. But the third thing is we have readers. Mm-hmm. And the business, you know, if we just go strictly by the business model, that's where the tough part is right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're, you know, trying to figure out ways to diversify and make sure that the folks who are not reading as much as they used to are finding ways to connect with us. That's important. But, you know, we have a dedicated readership, and we were able to rebuild that, you know, from, you know, over the past 10 years. Mm. And that's super important. When we don't take it, we never take it for granted.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting, too, that the model for newspapers in general has changed in the internet era. You know, here we are skating our way into the AI era. I was just getting comfortable with the internet era. But the idea was, you know, growing up that everyone read the newspaper. Everybody got a subscription to the newspaper. I was a paper boy, as I think, you know, many other people were during that time. I think Kevin Moran was as well. We had that conversation here. On the air.
Right? I was a substitute paper boy.
And, you know, hey, it was a common experience that everybody did. If you had a local paper, everybody subscribed to it because you just did. That's probably not the case anymore. A lot of people are getting their news and information electronically, either by the web or social media. Sometimes those sources can be sketchy. You know, maybe give us a little profile of the difference between a vetted journalistic story by a reporter through an institution like the Berkshire Eagle, and let's say a news story that comes out on a blog by some schmo.
Yeah, I mean, there's a major difference. And also, just to go back to your point about AI, that's what the Post also cited as one of their reasons for, you know, having the mass layoffs, is that their page views have been going down with AI, because AI overview on Google is a major factor on why newspapers, all publications, are having less views, having less readership, because this AI overview just pulls from our articles and gives this overview. But half the time it's incorrect or incorrectly done. But of course, a blog from a Joe Schmo is is one thing.
I mean, a lot of Facebook pages of scanners and, press information and things like that. How do we know the veracity of those things? They come out quickly. Sometimes they're correct, right? Sometimes they give you a nugget of information that needs to be sussed out a little bit more. It's part of the process, it seems like. But really, should people be getting their news only from a source like that?
I think when it's done right, you know, it's certainly the competition, if you will, puts everyone on their toes and ideally have you doing your best work. I mean, you don't simply sort of copy and paste, if you will. And I think a lot of what you see is copy and paste. You have no idea where it originated or who originally wrote it. For example, I'm on LinkedIn, and sometimes I'll see the same story about why you should be using AI. Gets repeated, you know, over and over again by different users. Like, is this viral? Is this a campaign? Is this people just thinking this is clever and I'm going to copy and paste this because I want the views? That's another aspect of it, isn't it? That, you know, sometimes people are posting content for the clicks because they want, you know, they're looking for exposure. They're trying to get their name or their brand out.
And you know, potentially monetizing through that platform.
And I'm not about the brand. I'm about, you know, we're about facts. Mm-hmm. And that's where our commitment is. And we hope you'll come along.
Not about the brand. It's about facts. And that is what we're talking about this morning on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. You're listening to the voices of Greg Sukenik and Mary Jane Williams, reporters at the Berkshire Eagle. Great conversation so far. We've got a lot more to talk about in the second half. We are going to take that top of the hour break that we always do, and we will return right after this, after we thank our underwriters and give you a station ID and all that other good stuff. This is Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Pittsfield Community Television has relaunched our website at pittsfieldtv.org with a new design to make it easier to find our live streams with PCTV Select, where you can watch live sports, city meetings, and more. Now it's simple to find our past shows on demand and future TV schedules. You can also quickly find information on how to be a member, our upcoming training sessions, and how to donate to PCTV. Check it out at pittsfieldtv.org.
Let's take a moment to talk about your wellness. Financial wellness, that is.
Go through the process of making a monthly budget. Even if it's not perfect, it's good to be aware of your financial health.
When shopping for insurance, ask your agent to shop around for you and see if you can bundle your policies.
This money hack brought to you by your neighbors at Greylock Federal Credit Union. All financial education and coaching resources are free and open to the public. Greylock Federal Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
People tune in to hear the latest local and national news.
That's not us.
People tune in to hear the latest music.
That's definitely not us.
People tune in to hear political pundits expound on politics.
No, that's not us.
How about people tune in to hear entertaining stories, jokes, odd topics, and laughter?
Oh, yeah, that's us. That's Stuff.
Tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 to listen to the latest Stuff with Bev Prentice and Lynn Arsenault on 89.7 WTBR-FM.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms. Customized solutions available. Online at Sandrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Yes, welcome back to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM. I don't often take requests, but when Greg comes in, I make sure that he gets his bumper music.
Well, that's the privileges of being a former WTBR-FM DJ, spinning records in the basement of Taconic High School.
That's right.
And you can't deny the bass line on this number. This
no,
is just
you cannot. The foundation of 1970s disco music.
Yeah, I feel like I'm driving over the Ben Franklin. I feel like I'm driving over the Ben Franklin Bridge right now. You know,
I'm watching Soul Train on Saturday morning at 11. Okay, well, welcome back to Morning Drive here. We will do the weather one more time and then get back to our conversation with Greg and Mary Jane. Here we go from the National Weather Service.
This is also a classic.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Extreme cold watch in effect from Saturday evening through Sunday afternoon. Today, mostly sunny. Cold with highs in the mid-20s. Northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Cold with lows around 3 above. North wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it. It is going to be cold, so dress appropriately over the weekend. One more time, we're going to get a weekend of extreme cold, mostly at night, though. But, you know, I think we're kind of used to it now. It still says 13 degrees here as we're waking up this morning on Morning Drive. Again, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lenox, and Stockbridge. And good morning again to Greg Sukenik and Mary Jane Williams. Thank you so much for being here this morning and chatting about journalism. We want to sort of spin it a little bit more local now and talk about some of the stories that each of you have been working on recently and been in the paper. I've got a stack of papers right here. See? Got the Berkshire Eagles right here. Always recommend that you pick up a physical copy of the paper, or I think I'm probably a bit of a dinosaur when it comes to that, but I still like leafing through the papers. Maybe that's my old paper boy days. I like the feel of a new, crisp Berkshire Eagle to start reading.
Something. Smell of ink.
Yeah, I think that's it. You know, just what it is. Mary Jane, let's start with you. Recently, you covered a story about a guest speaker at Taconic High School that maybe was less than ingenuous when it came to what the content of the speech was going to be in the school. And that was a story that you had to cover. What was that like?
Yeah. So actually, her speech at the school was the pre-approved speech. The speech itself was fine. But apparently what had happened is that she had reached out to the Taconic principal and asked to come in to help students write letters to veterans during this sort of, you know, student community day. Mm. I forgot exactly what they call it. Mm-hmm. So she came in on that, guys. She had prepared material. She had a prepared speech. All of it was reviewed by faculty and administration. And then essentially she brought in unauthorized materials. Mm. She ended up bringing in Turning Point USA brochures, materials, propaganda, just to say, like bracelets that say "We are Charlie Kirk," constitutions with Charlie Kirk's face on it.
None of these things as advertised, if you will, right?
Exactly.
The school didn't know that was coming.
The school knew none of this was coming. She wasn't authorized to hand out these things to students. And again, in the school's response, that is what they emphasized. It was not her exact beliefs that were the issue. It was not the beliefs that she was essentially advocating for, but it was the fact that she deceived the administration and brought in unauthorized materials. Not only that, but distributed them to students. Yeah. Like I talked to one parent who told me, like, thank God that it was just bracelets and pins, because you know, if she was able to distribute these materials to students,
you
who
can
knows
imagine
what else she could have.
Right. Yeah. You can imagine what else could have happened. And that, obviously, that will have some consequences and ripples through to figure out why that was able to happen. Right. And that was a story I know that I had seen, I think, earlier in that day from parents who were sharing those stories right on their social media, and to say, I'm outraged. And I'm like, OK, what's the outrage about now? You know, and it's sort of filtered in. And I'm like, that seems like bigger than just someone who's upset about something that happened at school. And sure enough, I think the Eagle had the story. You had the story within 12 hours or something like that. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. I mean, the second that we found out about it, we got on it. It was just a few hours late for that.
Where do the leads or the tips come from for a story like that?
So that one, it was from a parent who received. So the principal for Taconic sent out a voicemail to parents. Mm-hmm. And so this parent had received the voicemail. However, her child was not in school that day. So really, she called us and tried to, you know, what is this about? Yeah. And she found out that it was about the speaker handing out Charlie Kirk merchandise. And then so she immediately called us, and that's when we saw all the Facebook posts and we started reaching out to other parents. Essentially how we found out about it was the voicemail that was sent out.
Gotcha. And Greg, you've been working on many stories as well. You've had a couple of Pittsfield Public Schools stories under your belt. Certainly the state aid and the upcoming budget crunch, I guess. There was also a story, I think, in yesterday's Eagle about Dalton having a budget crunch as well. It wasn't written by one of you, but it looks like that might be a common story coming up in the next couple of months of municipalities, cities, towns seeing a sticker shock, if you will, some large increases, and then having to deal with that. What do you do when you're getting a 10% hit when you were expecting a 4% hit?
Right. That would be Dylan Thompson who wrote that, by the way. I want to name check him and send that out to him. He does great work for us. Educating. I mean, the bulk of education spending is salaries and benefits. And so you have contractually obligated, you're contractually obligated to raises that you've negotiated with the unions. So, I mean, those have to be paid for. And so when and costs increase, fuel costs more, materials cost more, right. Utilities cost more. So when those things go up and the state aid doesn't keep pace with inflation, that's when you get to a point where difficult choices have to be made. Mm-hmm. And Pittsfield, despite its, slight decrease in enrollment, some of it impacted by school choice, despite that, it's still, the students it has still have needs. And, some of those are special education driven, and that's not a question of want to, that's must, that's federal law.
Yeah.
So,
The other part of this story seems to be a formula that the state uses to calculate how much aid the city and the schools will get, right? And this came up a couple of years ago with the percentage of low-income students that are attending the school and whether you end up in group 11 or group 10. I don't understand all those details. I'm sure you've had to delve into that a little bit more.
A little more.
But that that seems to be a driving force where we're not going to be able to come back from that this year. It's hundreds of students that we would have to make up, not just five or six.
Yeah, right? And that's kind of decline related to a decline in enrollment. I don't think Pittsfield has, less of an issue with students who are coming to school with, economic disadvantages.
Sure.
I think that percentage is still probably pretty close. It's, I think that's something we're going to see, in gateway cities like Pittsfield across the state. I have to look into how this is repeated over and over again, because you have, cities that have lost population but still have need.
Yeah.
And I think, because this is only the governor's recommended, but in first recommended budget, and I'm certain in the legislature, might have other ideas.
Right.
So we'll see where that goes. We're just starting off, how this process, but because it impacts taxpayers so directly,
and of course it affects students and parents and schools directly as well.
So,
I mean, the headline number is a shocking one if you believe that that's the way it's going to play out.
Yeah.
Which is a potential $5 million loss.
Yeah.
How do the schools manage that? Is that the next part of the story? Is okay, what are the consequences of losing $5 million
if we get to it?
Budget?
I mean, do we have to talk about we might have to talk about layoffs, we might have to talk about potentially closing a school. I mean, those kinds of things are on the table. Or we're talking about an increase in taxes in a city where I'm not sure there's a whole lot of either appetite or even levy capacity to,
right.
If you really want to get technical, folks, and you're digging into Proposition 2.5.
That's part of the process, though, levy capacity allows you to raise taxes.
But that's meat and potatoes local journalism. And that's, where's the how much do we have to pay and where's the money going? And that's the sort of the bedrock of the work we do. And sometimes it's a little technical, sometimes it's dry, but it's important. And that's our job.
Yeah. Well, here's a story that was not all that dry, which was coffee and donuts out of a trunk. Mary Jane, you covered the story of the person who wanted to do a good thing and feed the homeless, but maybe wasn't doing it in quite the most sanitary means, and the city kind of called him out on that, and then there was a big kerfuffle at the city council meeting. How did that story play out?
Yeah, so I'd say not how people were expecting is how it played out.
Interesting.
So this individual was posting on social media about the fact that he was going and giving out these donuts and hot cider to the homeless. However, he said that he basically claimed that the city and the mayor was threatening him. He used the word fines, tickets, and basically that he wasn't allowed to give out this food. That was the claim. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That was the claim, which sparked a lot of outrage on social media to the point that a city councilor got involved.
So basically people believed that claim. That's the first side of the story. So the idea of journalism and reporting that story is then to what? Find the other side of the story.
Find the other side of the story, yes. So during the Pittsfield City Council, after that petition was put in by a councilor, basically requesting that the health department not fine or threaten to fine Good Samaritans who are trying to feed the homeless without having a clear outline on what the laws are. Essentially, when Andy Canby, who is the director of the health department, came up, he said, frankly, we've never fined him. We have never threatened to fine him. I don't know where this is coming from. The health department has not done this in the slightest. So it turns out after further discussion that the fines and tickets that he was referring to was a parking ticket that he received while giving out the food for the homeless because he parked on the wrong side of the road. So it was not necessarily a fine for feeding the homeless or from the health department at all. However, it was also what I heard feedback from, you know, counselors, from other citizens, was that it was helpful to have this discussion, though, so citizens know that they can do this. But of course, that the city prefers that you do it in a sanitary manner and that they will give you the guidance to do so. But of course, this still ended with that Samaritan saying that he wants to continue doing what he's doing and continue giving out food to the homeless.
And of course, one of the other facts that comes out during that story is the fact that the health department, the health board, has independent authority over these things, and that the mayor can't just instruct the health director to stand down from enforcement. They have their own ability to enforce things, and those are small facts, but you know, you don't understand it until maybe a story like that comes out. And Greg, let's shoot over to the PHS story, the report that a summary report that had come out. There were certainly school committee members that are that were elected based on the fact that they want to see the full report released to the public as much as possible in a redacted form. That story is still making its way around, and obviously it's a current issue at the school committee. It came up at the city council meeting the last time around, too. What is the next step in that particular story?
The next step is going to involve a black Sharpie. Because the committee has voted that they want to see this, but they also want to see the redactions first before they decide what's going to come out. Because, executive summaries of the allegations have already were published in the summer last year, but in terms of the full report, this is where the lawyers get involved and where there's concern about who's identified, whether witnesses are identified, and whether some of the concern about doing this is whether the witnesses would come forward if they knew that their names would be public it's a big city, but it's a small town, and it doesn't take much to follow the breadcrumbs to figure out, who did the talking.
Yeah.
So,
Wasn't that discussed the last school committee
that was
the whole point of whether they could or could not release the report was whether those details would be included in it and whether that opened up the city and the school department to a lawsuit.
Right. And the lawsuit is what brings out the Sharpie. Mm-hmm. And so redactions will happen. And so I guess the question is, will it be so redacted that releasing it actually gives you less details than what you got out of the executive summaries? Mm-hmm. And then we move on from there.
Yeah. Balance that that interest and that need for exposure of the report as, it was a report that was funded by taxpayer money.
$154,000 bucks of it.
The investigation that people want. They feel like they have a need to see it and they have a right to see it. And I'm sure and maybe you would tell me too, from a journalistic standpoint, how much of that do you think we have a right to see, and then balance that against the other concerns you just mentioned about potential legal issues and about privacy.
Right. Well, the public right to know is, these are public employees. This is public. These are public dollars that paid for it. So, that sort of lays it out in a very rather simple, perhaps simplistic case. Mm-hmm. But at the other side, these are employees who are working under the conditions of collectively bargained working conditions. And they've got, you know, state rights to privacy as well. And so it's a bit of a tightrope that the department has to walk in terms of trying to, the city has to walk in trying to, okay, well, is there a magic line where we're sort of honoring the intent of transparency here, but still protecting employees? And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I have the answers. I do not. It's a tough line to walk.
As a reporter, it's not your job
necessarily
to do that. It's the administration's job, right, to make sure that they are protecting their employees, they're doing the legal things, and then what you get at the end of the process is whatever they decide to release.
And typically, you know, we're going to fall on the side of, you know, public information is public information. Mm. That's our default setting. Mm-hmm. Then we sort of figure out what makes sense and what's, you know, what actually would be harmful or libelous.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's a big thing, too. I mean, another chilling of the First Amendment going back to our first half hour is the amount of lawsuits that have been filed by the federal administration against reporters, journalists, television. That liability is not insignificant. But the cost of that is not insignificant either.
Yeah. There are other situations, of course, when you have stories, both of you, that you would write that might involve victims of, say, sexual abuse or something like that, where publishing a name is definitely not a name of a victim, is not the right thing to do. And that you, even if you have that information, you're going to choose not to publish that. Is that generally the case? How do you, and I know it's a big hypothetical that I'm throwing out there.
Well, that's also another question of prior restraint, isn't
it? It is.
You know, I mean, ideally, you know, if you're starting with the absolute as the benchmark that, yeah, you would publish everything, but we've learned over time that can be really harmful. And so, I mean, that sort of comes to a kind of case by case judgment basis and having a policy that, you know, I mean, I worked at the Associated Press for 5 years, and there's a policy there about, you know, that we don't name, you know, people who are victims of sexual assault unless they come forward and actually, you know, say this in public.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of hard to hide a name when it's in a public document.
Mm.
You know, other people can FOIA that as well, and they can find it. Mm-hmm. And then you're sort of left in this weird position where, well, we're not naming this person, but everyone else could, you know, but it's readily available.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
Which,
you
know, goes to the,
these are the finer
Epstein
points.
Files as well, right? And the redactions there.
Sure.
And we'll never know, you know, if they're redacting people to protect them or if they're letting the victim names out where they shouldn't be. It's 3 million something documents. I guarantee they're not getting 100% of that right.
Yeah. Well, that's where context is important. That's where we do our jobs and apply the judgment that we've learned, you know, through knowledge and experience.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to 89.7 WTBR-FM. This is Morning Drive, hearing the voices of Greg Sukenik and Mary Jane Williams, reporters at the Berkshire Eagle, talking about some local stories that they've worked on here. Give me an idea of what you might be working on. Give me a couple of breadcrumbs, if you will, of stories that you're following and things that we might see coming up.
Stay tuned. So we have our annual education supplement, Making the Grade, coming up.
Hmm.
And we've actually got a number of really good stories coming up with that, you know, sort of looking at larger trends in education across the county. The growth of CTE, like vocational technical education, mm-hmm. one of them. Re-examining regionalization, which is something that came up several years ago and maybe didn't quite find a foothold. But, you know, enrollment trends have changed and finances
Certainly.
Have changed. I mean, you know, and this kind of goes back to a high school sports thing. It's like, you know, no one could never imagine, you know, years ago, Drury and Hoosick kids playing football on the same team.
Never, cats ever, and, ever.
Cats and dogs living together in harmony.
And yet, here we are.
Yes. And so, okay, well, you know, does this start
High
to
High and Taconic playing together as a team.
Yeah, there were once three high school football teams in this city.
Right, St. Joe, yep.
Yeah, St. Joe graduate.
There
I had to put that plug in there.
There you go.
There's a number of, you know, trends and things we're sort of looking at. We're working on that section.
Okay.
I'm doing some work on that as well.
Mary Jane, what have you got coming up?
On the city level, we are revisiting a very contentious issue from last year, which is the camping ordinance.
Mm.
This is the month that the Board of Health is supposed to finalize their recommendation for the city council on what to do if they want to how they alter the camping ban, if they're even going to propose any sort of, you know, variation of the ban, or if they're going to come up with a whole different policy. So that's going to be coming to City Council, I believe, at the end of this month, if not beginning of next month.
Yeah, and a lot of people, obviously, that story spent a lot of time at City Council during the second half of the last term, and it seemed like it was getting a parking place at the Board of Health, but a lot of people also thought that that was the appropriate place for a camping ban like that to go and to get some serious debate and discussion before coming back to the council. So you think that the Board of Health is ready to make some recommendations and kick it back to the full council?
I believe so. They've had very, very long and thought out debates about this. They've gone to other municipalities and gotten advice from, you know, other officials in other cities. They have really, really been putting their heads together to do this. So, I mean, if they're ready for it, I'd say that's the decision for them to make.
Right.
But they've definitely been doing their research. They've been doing their due diligence, and they've been putting in the work to get this done.
All right. Stay tuned for both of those stories and more from the Berkshire Eagle, from these fine reporters who are working every day to get that information for you. The public's right to know exactly what Greg said. In the last couple minutes we've got, I do want to talk about the next generation of journalists a little bit and the efforts that the Berkshire Eagle does to mentor new recruits, if you will, people that are just thinking about getting into journalism and sort of learning the ropes. Both of you, I'm sure, have memories of those first few days of being in journalism. Are you able to turn that around now for new folks coming in and giving them some wisdom and some good practices to make their journalistic careers successful?
Yeah, we actually had a couple of interns this past month from Williams College. So they were work. They did some work with a number of reporters on different stories. I mean, they came with me to the news conference after, you know, that Berkshire District Attorney Tim Shugrue held after the fatal shooting in Hinsdale.
Right.
They did some other. They're working on some other stuff as well. Ben and Ian. I have to admit, I don't remember their last names, which is horrible of me. My apologies, guys. And they're working with another intern of ours from the past, Ellie Davis, who's going to be editor in chief of the Williams Record this semester, and she's got another internship lined up with the Wall Street Journal, I think it is. So,
great.
There's moving. You know, it's great to see folks coming in and excited about this business. And I mean, like, this has been a tough business for a number of years. And so, there's kind of a perception out there that this is the buggy whip factory. So to see people still interested in it, you know, for younger professionals like Mary Jane, just getting her start here, and doing great work. It's heartening, and I enjoy doing the mentoring part of it.
Yeah. Mary Jane, what's it like for younger folks coming up in journalism right now? Is it still a noble profession, something that people should be pursuing and going to school for and cutting their teeth on?
I mean, personally, I'm a little biased, but I'd say
Fine. Absolutely.
At least in my experience in journalism school, professors, especially those with lived experiences, they're blunt. Like, they tell us how it is. This is not an easy job. You're probably not going to make much money. Like, you're probably going to get a lot of public ridicule. So I'd say for the most part, most upcoming journalists are aware of how the industry actually is, what they can expect, and what they can expect for worst case scenario.
Got to build up that thick skin, right?
Yeah. So that means that if they're coming into this profession, they are passionate enough.
Yeah. And it comes with the excitement of being in the middle of, the middle of the action.
It is. I guess that's the equation, right? That you know what you're getting into, but you want to do it. It's a calling. It's a passion. And it's important in our society. And it's something that we can't lose. We can't allow the slide. We got to keep fighting every day for that information. And what is the answer there? Subscribe to your local paper, people. What are you doing? Don't complain about the paywall. Greg Sukenik, Mary Jane Williams, thank you so much for being here this morning. Great conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Have you back another time. We'll talk about the stories of the day out there in Berkshire County and Pittsfield. All right, everybody. Little Steve Miller here for you, Greg. Heading out, and we'll see you tomorrow on Morning Drive. Take care, everybody.